Not that long ago, we listened to Lindsay Hazelgrave, a minister who used to be at Auld Lang, preaching on the prodigal son, another parable that she was talking about. And Sandy just read, Jesus spoke in parables greatly. I said we had an agricultural feel this one. We started with our first song, and now we've read this passage. But it's not this passage. I want to bring some thoughts to you on. We'll come to that a little later on. But Jesus used parables to teach people in a way that they could understand. And mostly he only explained them to those that are the closest around him, the disciples, as he did on this occasion. And we're never too sure, perhaps, whether Jesus used actual life experiences and built the, and spoke the parables through them. We think about the Good Samaritan. Well, that's something that he witnessed at some time, rather, or it's something that he thought this would be a good way of explaining a principle. He used it greatly. And it wasn't just limited to Jesus talking in parables. It happened much in the Old Testament as well. But what had happened? How would you feel if your whole life was, or God asked you to live your whole life as a living parable? As a living parable. Bit like Ezekiel, a prophet who was greatly used by God. And if you ever read Ezekiel, you'll know that it started off his calling was the fact that he saw this great, he saw the glory of God. And there's something that he describes that we can't even understand nowadays. It's the thing with wheels within wheels and eyes on wheels, and it moved this way and that way, and it didn't seem to change direction and things like that. All this was going on. We can't understand it. It's almost like science fiction to us. That's what Ezekiel saw, and that was the glory of God. But God called him to do something very special. And he was called to live out his life as his parable. He was called, almost straight off saying that, to speak to Israel as a parable. He was asked by God, told by God, commanded by God, for 40 days and 40 nights, you must lay on your right side. And that was to be a sign to Israel of their apostasy at that time. But that wasn't quite enough. He said, after those 40 days, you've got to turn onto your left side and lay on that for 40 days and 40 nights as a sign to Judah, because you had this divided kingdom at the time. But both were going into apostasy. Judah was to do that a little later than Israel, but they would follow suit nonetheless. This is all before, obviously, they were taken into captivity. So this poor man just wondering what he had to do. In actual fact, I mean, there were other things that were added onto that. The way he had to eat his food, laying on your side, that's not easy. Can't be good for your digestion, can it, really? But that's what he was told to do. Whether he was given a bit of time off, 10 minutes to cook a meal and down it, again, not good for your indigestion. We're not too sure exactly how that all worked out for him, but we just know that's what he's called to do. And there were so many other things that Ezekiel was called to do, but I won't say now because there's so much of it. If you remember what Paul said, the Apostle Paul said, about all the things that he had gone through in his life, all the shipwrecks, the beatings, the having to be lowered down from a city wall in a basket so he could escape, being beaten up, and then just getting up and turning around, going back in again and starting to preach again. All those things he was listing on that. I wonder what Ezekiel would list in his life, because it's very, very similar. A living parable. But what I want to think about a bit more this morning, a little bit perhaps more detail than that, is the prophet Hosea, another one who was called by God to live his life as a living parable. He was told, Hosea was told by God to marry an unfaithful wife. There's a program entirely called Loose Women. Well, that's kind of, you know, a little bit, we've talked about loose women before, haven't we? And that's the kind of wife that he was asked to marry, somebody who was likely to be unfaithful to him, who had not been the best she could be during her life, even before he married her. Her name was Gomer. He was told to go and find a wife, and he chose Gomer as being this unfaithful woman, this woman of loose morals, we might say, to marry her. And he's told to love her. And this is another picture of what God wanted to say to his people at that particular time. So he did. He went and married her. And he had three children by her. One was called, and you know, there's in the Bible, so many people have been given names that mean something. Now, I want to tell you one, my name means Richard because it just sounds so high flown. It's, you know, just an amazing name, really. Unfortunately, I'm not too sure I've been able to live it out too well. But anyway, that's beside the point. Names are important, especially in those ancient times. And quite often names were given when God was asking somebody to take on a new ministry or something like that, and that would signify the ministry going into that sort of thing. The first son they had between them was called Jezreel. And that was as a reminder to Israel that there'd been a massacre by God's people, you know, an unholy massacre. And God was just reminding them of that account at the time, saying, you've got much to put right. Then they had a daughter, had a second child, which was a daughter. Her name is called Lo Ruhama. And that means not loved. That's something that you wouldn't want to call your daughter not loved, would you? Because we all want to love our daughters. But again, this is what God was showing Israel, that he was getting to the point where he could not love them anymore and he wanted to speak to them in that way. And then they had a second son, a third child, a second son. His name was Lo Ami, which means not my people. You wouldn't want somebody who thought they were so close to God, had been given so much to God, and was so assured that they were God's people, that he would say to them, but you're not my people. But there are reasons for that. That's not the end for poor old Hosea. You think that'd be enough, wouldn't you, really? A man happened to marry a wife that he knows is going to be unfaithful to him, knows all the history, knows all she's likely to be like, and he's had three children with him, so he's with her. So he's kind of nailed down, if you like, that marriage to her, no children. But Gomer, his unfaithful wife, adds insult to injury. And she leaves Hosea for another man. How must he have felt? You know, this woman that God has told me to go and love, because God loves his people, as unfaithful as she may be, I've got to love her. And I have these three children with me. Now she's gone. Just left me and she's gone off with somebody else. But still, it's not the end. God tells him to go and fetch her back, and he has to pay a price for her. Can't remember exactly how much it was. I think it might have been 20 coins of some sort, plus some goods he had to give to the man that was now possessing his wife and to buy her back. And God said, you must go back and love her as you did before, as I commanded you to. What could that have meant to him? What was that to do to his pride? But he did it. He came back and he said, but you must be faithful to me now. So this to Gomer, you must be faithful to me now. as I will be faithful to you. So for all that you've done, I will be faithful to you. All that you've been, I will remain faithful to you. You must remain faithful to me. Again, he was saying that to Israel. And he paid a price. And I should be speaking to us now about the price that Jesus paid for us. In fact, the price that's paid for Jesus by the Pharisees to Judas, that Judas tried to give back. Jesus has paid that price as he did for there. And as God does for his people and us. In Hosea, God doesn't have too much good to say about Israel. And I'm talking about Israel and Judah together there. Although he does say, as part of the narrative in Hosea, that he will continue to love Judah, but they are still becoming an apostate nation within themselves. He accused them of unfaithfulness, adultery toward him, having no love for him, or acknowledgement even of him, of murder. Again, that's back to Jezreel. Lying and stealing, idolatry, religious falsehood and arrogance. And God promised a harsh retribution upon them if they didn't change. But there is always hope with God. There's hope for Israel, there's hope for us, there's hope for Judah. And he gives them a glimpse or perhaps a pointer of what he expects of them. And the way back to him in yet another parable. And I suppose this is really what I want to speak to you more, because it spoke to me as I read it a few weeks ago now. And that's from Hosea 10, verse 12, and Hosea relates these words. Sow righteousness for yourselves, reap the fruit of unfailing love, and break up your unplowed ground. For it is time to seek the Lord until he comes and showers his righteousness on you. That set up a question for me. And it came from that line in the middle there of, and break up your unplowed ground. And it made me think, what unplowed ground have I got? And what is, you know, what's the significance of ploughing? And it just struck me at the time, about ploughing, how God had chosen Hosea to relate these words to Israel. Hosea. Ho being probably one of the earliest forms of plough. And it just seemed weird, you know, God to choose him to do it. Over all the other prophets, he chose Hosea to do this. And it just made me smile. You know, sometimes God has this sense of humor that breaks through. I'm sure he has got a sense of humour. He must have, because he's called us. So he's got to have a sense of humour, isn't he, really? But that set this question in me. What kind of hard, uncultivated ground do I need to break up? So I needed to find out more about ploughing. I need to find out more about ploughing. So I looked it up. And I'll just read you some of the things that I read. Obviously, it comes off the internet. Good source, if you know, if you can believe all of what you read on the internet. I'm sure this is true. The process of crop production involves a total of 7 steps. It's interesting that 7 means something in the Bible. It's perfection, I think it is. 7 often denotes perfection. So the process of crop production involves a total of 7 steps, whether in a field or in a garden. Preparation of the soil, ploughing, breaking up hardened soil. The prime purpose of ploughing is to turn over the uppermost soil, bringing fresh nutrients to the surface while burying the weeds and previous crop remains allowed to remain in there and to be squashed down and to decay. I thought about that and I thought, yeah, every parable that we think up, every story we think up, or anything like that, we try to say that explains something, fails somewhere along the line. And God doesn't necessarily bury the things that bother us. He does dig them up and he discards them completely, burns them away. But for the purposes of agriculture, they are buried to decay, and they actually feed the new plants. So ploughing and cultivating soil evens the content of the upper 5 to 10 inches of the soil. And that's where most plant feeder roots grow, the ones that we want to grow to feed ourselves. That's where they gain the most nutrient, etc., in those top 10 inches of soil. Ploughing actually aerates the soil. I remember talking to somebody recently and said, you know, because the idea about ploughing is changing, and because of global warming, etc., people look in the ways they don't want to plough anymore because it releases the carbon from the soil into the atmosphere again, and it's causing some of this global warming. So they're trying to not to plough anymore. But in not ploughing anymore, it means that they have to use chemicals to replace some of the things that would naturally be turned over in the soil. Not ploughing can cause erosion because the soil dries out and can be blown away. The chemicals I spoke of just now, we hear about what they call ground runoff into rivers. And we find a lot of our rivers, the aquatic animals that are in there, and the fish, etc., are dying off because of the chemicals that are in the water, and the water's not fit for them to live in, even them anymore. Certainly not fit for us to drink or even to swim in. So the change, some of the change, not all, not everybody would say that's the right thing to do, to go these new ways, but to realise that there's good and bad in both. Playing and cultivating, sorry, it aerates the soil. Actually, somebody else said to me once as well, because they're not ploughing so much now, there's not so much of worm life in those top few layers. And that has a penalty to pay for as well, because the worms can't get through that hard soil. And where possible, it's done in the cold season. And the overturned vegetation is left to decompose when the soil is still warm, leaving needed nutrients for new crop growth. I mentioned that earlier. Ploughing is one of the most important agricultural techniques that dates back to ancient times. I said Hosea's time, perhaps that early hoe, the earliest plough. But once that process is done, there's another process that takes place, and that's the sowing, isn't it? It's less productive sowing in unprepared soil. Whatever way you do it, whether it's this new way to stop carbon entering into that atmosphere, is debatable perhaps, but still needs to be prepared some way or other. That might be adding fertilizers and manures. You have to feed the land. You have to feed the soil to have strong growth. And then, of course, irrigation, the watering of the soil. Much effort, time and money is spent on watering for a harvest. The machinery. I was walking, doing some photography one day, and I could see this massive field. I had three or four of these big spray things out there, and the thousands and thousands and thousands of gallons that had to be tipped onto that land to irrigate it, and the cost of that, the paying of the water, the equipment, the time it takes to place it, move it from one place to another, all cost money. And that's why a lot of farmers are saying these new ways where we don't necessarily have to do that quite so much are better because it saves us money. Removal of the weeds and herbs and the pests. Often the most irksome and back-breaking part of it, whether it be in a garden or a field, it needs to be done. How much more so when it involves those things that God accused the Israelites of? All that apostasy that I mentioned earlier. And then, of course, there's harvesting. the joy of seeing. And I can imagine what it's like when a farmer goes out into a field and says, yeah, that's ready. And there are certain times when the harvest has to happen. We were on holiday and right next to a farm, and saw this huge, great silo. And we were trying to work out what, there was something on the side of it. We couldn't work out what it was. And it suddenly dawned on us that it was a silo for grain. And a friend of mine at work, whose dad used to work on a farm, said there were certain times you couldn't harvest grain when it's too wet. You had to wait for the sun to get on it because it had to be dried afterwards. And that's what the silo was for, purely for drying the grain so they could bring it in when perhaps the price was the highest for it, rather than have to wait a week or two for it to dry out and then be able to harvest it. But it's the joy of a farmer seeing that all that work that he's done before, in the irrigation, in the toiling on land and everything, all he's done, the joy of seeing that job being well done and enjoying the fruits of that harvest. And then, of course, the grain has to be stored. And there's that sense of preserving, isn't there? Preserving what you've harvested. Why would you want to just leave something you spent so much time on, so much money on, so much effort on, out to be wasted in the open? Been wasted, the harvest, through neglect. It's interesting that God chose Hosea, isn't it, to relate all of this to him, to them. None of us, I'm sure, are like those Israelites, where God could tell us about our apostasy. Or are we? Or could we? What pointers are there for us? And as I read it, for me, in that verse, break up your unplowed ground. What unplowed ground do you have? What unplowed ground do I have? What needs releasing in my spiritual life? And what needs releasing in your spiritual life? Perhaps your unplowed ground could be mistrust. Like Thomas, who came to Jesus and said, I can't believe in your resurrection until you show me your hands and your side. And Jesus said, put your fingers there. Do it. Are you in bondage to some sin? A bit like Gomer. Or a bit like the woman caught in adultery, who Jesus forgave and sent her away to continue to sin no more. Perhaps you struggle in relationships. We can all do that, can't we? We find it easier to love some people than we do others. It's always the same. But perhaps that's something that we need to break that up a little. Perhaps it's possessions, like the rich young man who came to Jesus and said, what more can I do? And he said, well, give up all that you have. Follow me. And he found that so hard to do. But as I said, there's always hope with God. And a bit further on, in chapter 11, Hosea relates these words of God and God's promise to Israel and the hope that he gives them. And I hope he gives us as well, I hope. How can I give you up, Ephraim? How can I hand you over, Israel? How can I treat you like Admar? How can I make you like Zebulun? I never did look up who they were or the towns, I'm sure. They have some meaning, obviously. My heart is changed within me. All my compassion is aroused. I will not carry out my fierce anger, nor will I devastate Ephraim again, for I am God and not a man. The Holy One among you. The Holy One among you. Sadly, we know from what Hosea continued to say that they didn't change. That led me to a question. Will I change? Will you change? Will I seek the Lord? Will you seek the Lord? And how do we seek him? In a recent leaders meeting, Steve was saying he looked up some facts and figures and found out that even Christians nowadays often cannot find more than 5 minutes a day to read the Bible, if that. And I can understand that. When I was at work, and I was a Christian while I was at work, I came to Christ much later in life, but that was while I was still at work, and I had a long time at work, and I didn't used to find time to read the Bible for much longer than that, if that. And it's only since retirement I've found much more time to do that. So I understand the difficulties of it. I understand the difficulties of having children around you when there's nothing but noise and you can't find that quiet time, that quiet place to spend with the Lord. But when you can, it's such benefit to us. It's such a joy. It's lovely when God specially speaks to you. So through consistent Bible reading, and if you can, study as well. Many of you I know will use different books to help you in that. It's interesting, I found out that women will tend to use devotional books, where men will tend to have a concordance or some other form of study beside them, which is different in that way. But whatever works for you, it's just doing it and allowing God to speak into your life that helps. We spoke about a time as a prayer, but there's always obviously time for our own private, quiet prayer with God, spending time with him, just in the silence sometimes. And sometimes it can come out in a rant and a rave, can't it? Sometimes it just come out in a quiet whisper from us to him, and he whispers back to us. And through the support of the fellowship that we are part of here this morning, being church together. I'm sure we all have unplowed ground. Some may be a garden, and some have bigger gardens than others, but they still need work on them to make them fruitful. But some, in some of these things that I mentioned this morning, may be field size. As I read through this, break up your unplowed ground, I had to ask God, say, well, where's my unplowed ground, Lord? What is it you want to do in me? What is it you want to till in me and to make me better for you? That's a work in progress very much. And I pray that the Lord will speak to you and perhaps how he wants you to break up your unplowed ground with his help. I just want to pray as we close this part. Just want to pray for us.